You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
This is Joe Belliotti. You're listening to Rebel Radio.
My name's Rebecca Jolly, and you're listening to Rebel Radio.
Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. Today, we are talking to Joe Belliotti and Rebecca Jolly, the authors of How Music Grows Brands. If you work in brand partnerships or the music industry or marketing or anything related to that, you're going to want to listen to this one. These two are at the top of the game as far as brand partnerships are concerned. Joe used to be head of music at Coke and was also partners with Chris Lighty in a brand consultancy. And Rebecca was the North American CEO of the publisher of Mixmag, Kerrang, The Face. And she also led partnerships for SFX and some of the world's biggest festival brands. They both consult brands on music strategy, and their book is great. I read it cover to cover. It's a blueprint for how to do it right and make sure that everybody's winning so they keep investing. We get into some fun stories from their journeys and mine, lessons learned, and I think you're going to like it. Let's get into it right now. I want to start with you guys and a little bit of your history. Do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
Oh, God, I don't want to admit it. Bearing in mind, I grew up in the UK in the 80s. Mine was, Jason Donovan.
I don't know.
Do you know? You don't? Do you know the soap opera, the Australian soap opera, Neighbours?
No.
What? Oh, gosh, I'm speaking to the
We're terribly cultural
in the Do you know Kylie Minogue?
Yes.
Right.
Of course.
Okay.
Love Kylie Minogue.
There was an Australian soap opera called Neighbours, and Everybody was in the UK. Everyone was completely obsessed with it. It was on twice a day, and everyone used to watch it twice a day. And there was Kylie and Jason were like the two main love interests.
Oh, no way.
Yes. And okay. So, yeah, hit that. It was a soap star's pop album, was the first one I ever bought.
All right.
I wish I'd had prep on that question. No, I'd have thought of something much cooler.
You got to start somewhere. And it's funny, our musical journeys. We have no control over where they start,
yeah.
Right? And, we learn from friends or family or... Mm-hmm. Joe, what about you? What was your first
record? We had records around the house, like Rolling Stones, Cat Stevens, but the first one I ever bought, 1984, Van Halen.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was a big one.
That's
right?
Great.
I mean, Jump, that was like a...
Yeah.
It was funny, though, think about it. It was a synth hit, like synthesizer-driven hit for a guitar band, right? Like, that was their first sort of, like, big mainstream, like, coming out of...
I have their memoir, his memoir, in my list. I haven't read it yet, but apparently it's it's an amazing story. These guys were like Indonesian, growing up in outside of Pasadena, and completely kind of shut out and sort of figured out this outsider thing on their own and became maybe the best guitar band of all time or one
That's
of
awesome.
Them. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, and then how did music become your career path? What was the point where you realized this is what I'm going to do for my life?
Me?
Do you want to go first?
I had a friend who lived two houses down, and we weren't good at sports, so all we would do is try to, like, music, you know, mm-hmm. make instruments, buy instruments, whatever. So we played in bands when we were in high school, and I was terrible. I mean, like, just, I mean, like, people say they're bad, but then they pick up a guitar and they're really good. No, I'm really bad.
Okay.
So, yeah, but I love music, and mm-hmm. he actually went off and had a career as a children's artist, but I decided, all right, I want to get into the music business side of it, which I knew nothing because I was from Providence, Rhode Island, and there's no music industry there. Shocking. So I went to Berklee College of Music, studied uh-huh. music production.
Nice.
And thought I'd do that. Came out to L.A., got a job at Maverick when it was on Beverly Boulevard. So it was a record label publishing company back in the day, Alanis Morissette, Deftones. I got a job at the studio and did that for a few months until I was able to get a job in music publishing, which I knew nothing about, didn't even know the job existed.
Sure.
And that's what you do. You kind of learn, you figure things out, and then that sort of evolved into music for film and TV, supervised some TV shows, some movies, then got into advertising, and then really like that because at the time there was very few people like me and you that were connecting brands with the music mm-hmm. ecosystem. So I moved to New York, started an agency with Chris Lighty, who was a hip-hop manager, 50 Cent, Diddy, LL Cool J, Busta Rhymes, and we started going out to brands and helping them connect with pop culture through music.
Yeah.
And Coke became a client of ours in 2008, maybe. Mm. And 2010, I joined Coke as head of global music, did that until end of 2017, then decided no more corporate. But I still love the music and brand thing, so I started doing it on my own. And then, the whole time, like, the writing the book kind of, was something that I felt like there was an opportunity to do because, still to this day, I don't think there's enough connection between the music and the brand world.
Sure.
You know, especially when you look at things like sports or influencer marketing from an investment level.
Yeah.
And then, I met Rebecca and we started bouncing it around and it actually happened.
Well, it's a great book, yeah. How Music Grows Brands. Where's the camera?
But wait.
Well,
we need the Rebecca story. Curious. How did you get into this? Like, we've never actually talked about this.
No, I definitely want to hear the story. But I just want to say, we met in 2017.
Yeah.
I was working with Linkin Park as handling all their brand partnerships. We had a global deal with Mercedes, so I went to Atlanta to meet with them, and I was looking on LinkedIn, who else is in Atlanta that I can see while I'm there? Mm. And saw your name, cold called you, I think, or cold emailed you and said, hey, I'm going to be in Atlanta. That's the power of the Linkin Park name, is that people will take your calls. So anyway, you taught me two things in that meeting.
I don't remember. This is not going to be good.
That have stuck with me. And one is kind of what you alluded to was the difference between, say, music and sports, right? And you said in that meeting, you're like, look, we don't spend a lot of money in music compared to other areas like sports. Because sports you can plan against. You have a season that's well thought out, years ahead of time. You have a stadium. You can plan depletions. You can plan volume against it. You can market against it to all of that. And he's like, music, they call me 6 weeks ahead of a tour, maybe, and need $1 million, and there's no plan for how anyone's going to benefit, right? So that was really helpful for me to sort of think about, right? I went back and said, okay, what are we going to plan out that we can then go take to brands? And the other thing you said, some version of music doesn't sell Coke. Linkin Park is not going to sell Coke. Right, and that was something that that was a conversation I had had, many times with different artists. Is they're like, oh, we're gonna help them sell cars. I want a royalty on every car we sell. I'm like, if Toyota or Ford or whoever needs you to sell their cars, they have bigger problems. Right, this is a multi-billion-dollar company. It can't all rest on your endorsement, right? And so, what I take from that, it's more about how do we work together and help each other along the way, right?
That's what it is. Because I think that's where too many brands look at it. It's like, how are you going to help me sell my product?
Right.
And you can't put all that weight on one activation, one artist, one idea,
for sure.
Right? And I think that's why the Mercedes thing worked out really well. Because, I mean, that was a relationship. You guys had a relationship. You did a ton of things. Like, I went to the event in Atlanta where you had the setup and you had the designed car and, like, mm-hmm. The band was there, like, hanging out and meeting people. Like, there was a lot of value, over a long period of time that both probably got.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the big things that the band got, and hopefully I helped them with, was work with brands you like, because you're gonna have to show up, right? And we got a nice deal done with Mercedes, in large part because they flew to Germany, they hung out with the CEO, the CMO, and they talked to them as human beings, right? The night we signed our deal, I went to dinner with the CEO of Mercedes China, and I took him to the side and thanked him, and he goes, look, I could spend my money anywhere. These are great guys, and I like what they do and what they stand for, but they're also good people, and it makes me happy to support them. And you can't overlook that human element, right? If we look at, you know, one of the things that I see wrong is we look at these people as media channels, right? We look at them as just a conduit to an audience, and you overlook that human connection.
But people do overlook the human connection a lot, and I feel like that's what harbors the... There's so many examples of kind of resentment, like brands know that...
Sure.
Artists know that they need brand dollars and vice versa, but that connection doesn't get deep enough often, and so people, what kind of artists resent the work that they have to do for the brand because they feel like it devalues what they do. And Joe and I talk a lot and make a case for building that real kind of approaching a partnership in such a more, like it sounds like you did with Mercedes and Linkin Park, like a really kind of collaborative program where you all kind of lay your cards on the table and understand what you need to get from a partnership like that. We kind of talk often about how kind of on the music side, like look at whether it's an artist or a music platform or something, needs to really look at what they want to achieve over the next few years and like let the brands into that and figure out how they can help facilitate that and build that kind of partnership. And it doesn't happen often. You just often get that kind of really arbitrary, like transactional partnership, which then like fades out really quickly.
Check it. We're back with DraftKings. They're supporting us, so I hope you'll support them. Plus, their offer is pretty cool if you're into sports betting. Football is back in full swing with another week of epic games, and who's got you covered on the action for every single one of them? DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. New customers can bet $5 on football and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Nobody's missing out on the action this season. All DraftKings customers can take advantage of two new offers every game day this September. Get in on the NFL Week 2 action with DraftKings Sportsbook. Download the app now and use my code REBELRADIO to sign up. New customers can bet just $5 and take home $200 instantly in bonus bets. Only on DraftKings Sportsbook with this code REBELRADIO. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. See sportsbook.draftkings.com/football terms for eligibility, terms, and responsible gaming resources. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. Eligibility and deposit restrictions apply.
Well, so let's go back a little bit. Take us through a bit of your history. How'd you come to music as a career?
Well, probably similar to Joe in terms of like probably born out of the fact I had very little musical talent myself.
Did you try?
I did. Like, but I mean, really, like, kind of thanklessly. Like, I tried to learn the piano for years and years and years and pushed, like.
So we're not going to find old YouTube videos of your band, high school band, or something.
No, I'm older than that. So okay. Thankfully, and then I just got into music. I actually went to university in Manchester, and it was just kind of on the tail end of the real like blow up of the Manchester music scene. Yeah. So I think it was maybe just a year or so after the Hacienda closed, and just I got. But there was a. There was still, it was a real music city, and there were some awesome, as well as all the kind of Manchester music that we know it for, there was some brilliant, like, clubs and promoters and lots of, and labels in Manchester at the time. And I just got really into it then and ended up starting to run my own music nights there. I worked at, with Fat City Records for a while and kind of really bedded into it there. And then I moved down to London and started running my own nights in East London. I ran like a kind of punk rock night and like emerging band nights, and always just kind of, it was always a hobby though, always really, really a hobby. And then at some point felt like I had to get a grown-up job. And so went into the brands, like went and worked for agencies. I worked for an ad agency, was kind of my first job, and hadn't ever really kind of thought that I could, it was kind of one or the other, like music was a hobby and then I had the job. And then I actually got approached for a job when I was about 25 working for, to move to Amsterdam to work for a big festival company, like a company called ID&T who ran Sensation and Mysteryland and Tomorrowland, and they wanted someone who had brand and music knowledge to be able to run a big partnership that they had with Samsung. And so that was my first experience of putting brands and music together and figuring out like what that could do. And so it's all just kind of gone from there. And I then kind of danced about between agency side and representing the brand and kind of the music side of the business. Joe and I actually met first time, although I can't, neither of us really can remember meeting, but when we did a partnership with, I moved to the US, I moved to New York to be part of the team launching Spotify in the US because I'd worked for them in the UK. And Joe was working at Coke, and we did, there was a partnership between Spotify and Coca-Cola. So yeah, that, but then I kind of worked on that side. Then I went back to ID&T in the ID&T in the US, and we were acquired by SFX, which with a kind of ambition to turn it into a big entertainment company. And then I launched Mixmag over in the US as well. So it's always been like entertainment, music media, that kind of side. And so probably for the last 12 years or so, I've worked more on the music side of it, whereas Joe's brand side. So we kind of came together on a project a few years ago and realized we had both had these kind of together a really rounded perspective of like the music and brand world and, and all the pain points within it, all the learnings of kind of how not to do things, but also just, I think we kind of really bonded over the fact that we felt there was a real need to kind of help navigate, or like we spent both spent decades trying to kind of figure out both sides of the industry. And we're like, if only there was something that kind of helped simplify it or helped you navigate either side of it. And a few more calls later, we're like, maybe we should just write it. So yeah.
That's great.
Here we are.
Nice. We met a second time at Tomorrow World. Remember when they did the Atlanta version of Tomorrowland?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Which the first couple of years were fantastic. Then the third year had a weather thing. It got rained out.
Right?
I don't know if you went to that.
It was
I always heard. Yeah. I mean, I've always heard that Tomorrowland is the best festival in the world.
It is. I mean, it was. I think it really changed the game for festivals. Like a bit. I think it was one of the first festivals or live experiences to really understand media and to understand that the strength of the festival wasn't just the 150,000 people who were there. It was, and that, you know, they were the first ones to do those, to live stream and to do those amazing after movies, they called them, which were like, everyone does an after movie for something and they're like 2 minutes long.
Terrible.
They were like, nah, this is going to be an hour long. And it was just, I just remember being in, I was in living in London at the time when they first started to do that. And just in every office you went into, people would be watching it.
Really?
Like, it was huge. That yeah, they really did that. And I think the US one didn't work as well. I think I don't, for various different reasons, I don't think. And then the third iteration of it was a bit of a disaster. They were really unlucky, I think, with weather and a lot of things. But we met there again.
The first 2 years, the festival itself was fantastic. Like, I thought it was incredible. Like, you know, I mean, just what they pulled off, like out in the woods, and they did it in a really sustainable way. So it left no footprint after the festival. Like,
that's
really well done.
Yeah. And they've also, I mean, they've really evolved now. Like, they now have Tomorrowland, like hotel retreat in Morocco, and which actually looks beautiful. But I mean, yeah, it's an experience. It's quite an onslaught on the senses. I don't know how I would fare in a Tomorrowland festival these days.
Fair enough. Yeah. So what? I think I love that you have that background in club promoting. I think everyone should be forced to promote a nightclub, work food service, retail.
You know, all the dirty secrets, and you really have to roll your sleeves up.
Absolutely.
When things like that. Someone doesn't turn up and you end up having to DJ yourself.
And I think there's such great life lessons in those jobs. What'd you learn from that you still use today, or that's helped you along the way?
that, like, maybe the hustle, and also the end-to-endness of it. Like, actually, from, like, designing the flyers, booking the artists, like, trying... Also, the marketing part of it was a real lesson, like, how to try and kind of get people along to those things to start with. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it all carries through into what I do today in some way.
I love that. I mean, I promoted clubs for a while here in L.A., and for me, the biggest thing was, like, we'd have a great night. You'd, you know, be up till 4 or 5 in the morning, and then you wake up, and you have another show in a week.
Yeah.
And you're, like, already behind.
Totally.
And I remember that, like, there's a big lesson there. Yeah. Right? Like, it's you got to keep going.
Yeah. Also, yeah, to that point, also learned to drink really well.
Absolutely.
That was a good education.
For sure. Well, I think, you know, I love what you said about we need a guide, or we need guides, because this stuff that you guys are talking about, so many people get wrong. There's so many sort of pitfalls, and so I'm curious, in the process of writing the book, what did you guys learn? You obviously have all this experience that you brought to it to begin with. What'd you learn when you were writing?
I think the hardest thing was figuring out how to simplify the things that we do intuitively, right? And I think any of us that have done brand partnerships and have done it well, you kind of have this methodology that you take yourself through. And that's what we try to do, is figure out, like, all right, what are the steps? What are the things we think about that brands should consider, that the music industry should consider, like, and really creating some structure around it, and creating some tools and some frameworks and some criteria. So they're asking themselves the right questions, and that's sort of the essence of, like, you know, where we started from the methodology part of the book, and everything else around it was to show examples of, you know, when you use pieces of this methodology, here's how it could work. Here are best case examples. I think we put in a couple of not things we've done that didn't work as well, because we all have those.
Sure.
But I think, you know, coming back to the core of it, it's to help brands, but it's also to help brands invest smartly in the music industry, so that way the music industry and the artists benefit, and then ultimately the fans benefit, because they're getting better experiences, more content. So it's the ultimate win-win-win. And we felt like we needed to write it from both points of view, like not just from a brand marketing point of view, but also from a music industry point of view, so they could better work with brands. And it's like, it kind of...
Absolutely. You know,
just, it's we hope it's a guide that works equally well, whether you're sitting on the music side or the brand side of the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's... you don't realize how much of it is second nature to you, so to try and kind of like draw that out of your head and then kind of make it a bit more formulaic. And also, I think that what we're talking about is, it's obviously so passion led in so many ways, it's also a very emotional thing, and it's also a lot of what we do and the way we work is because we have the community, we've worked in the community for a long time, so we know how to kind of do those things really easily. So to then try and take that into a way that, A, we can simplify it, but make it seem accessible and kind of without bypassing any of that trying to kind of crystallize it into something that simplified things, but also helped navigate a world which is kind of very passion driven. That was a challenging bit of it, I think.
Interesting. Mm. So you talk about something in the book about the win-win-win, which is central to this whole thing, right? The idea that the brand needs a benefit, the promoter, artist, whoever on the industry side needs a benefit, and the fan. What have you done to sell that in to both sides?
Both sides of the table are guilty of the same thing most of the time, which is starting with the tactic, right? Uh-huh. Like, brands will do it all the time. They'll come to us and they'll say, we want to do a partnership with this artist. Okay? What do you want to do with them? Well, we don't know yet. You know, well, why are you doing it? You know, well, it's a good question, right?
Yeah.
So they start with the tactic as opposed to the strategy and the objective. And I think same thing is true on the music industry side, where, yes, you want to get a deal done, but you need to start, instead of saying, let's do a deal with such and such, like understanding a little bit better, like how that could benefit the brand, right?
Sure.
So I think, it tends to be and I'm generalizing quite a bit, but it tends to be a very transactional space. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work as well as, let's say, movie partnerships is a great example to me, where this is sort of pre-COVID, of course, you know, but I guess it's true now because movies are back. Mm-hmm. But a brand would partner with the movie, and they'd have, each would know their objective really well. The movie studio wants to get people in the theater on opening weekend. And the brand wants to use that IP to, you know, connect with, you know, consumers, and they'll create commercials with their, you know, the car and promote the movie, and they're using their media and their dollars to promote a movie, mm-hmm. because they're part of that pop culture conversation, and the movie benefits because they're driving people to the theater. And there's very, very clear objectives. There's different objectives, but they're both, you know, working together.
Yeah.
And the music part of it is not really built on that. There's not that type of thinking that goes into it. And I think there's some examples where, you know, whether it's a new artist or a tour where, all right, it's like, we want to sell tickets, we want to, you know, promote the new album, and you can build packages around that. There are opportunities for that to happen. Mm-hmm. I don't think they happen enough, though.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think it's really evolved, though, and I think that it used to be the case that, I think, from the music side, a brand partnership was always something that was kind of like maybe something that you would do, but you didn't have to because you made all your money from touring or from sales of your music, which just doesn't happen as much these days. And so it was, because it wasn't needed as much, I don't think, there was not very much thought went into it. And it was like, well, if we need some extra money, we'll take that deal and, you know, they can sponsor whatever they want to sponsor. And I think the shift in the music industry and the commercial side of the music industry has made the need for brands to be involved a lot more kind of pertinent. And with that, I think, has come that kind of slowing down and figuring out how to collaborate to do something that benefits both sides a little bit more, and kind of allowing, I think the music side has allowed the brand side in more, and mm-hmm. the brand side has allowed and kind of understood that if they're going to do it properly, they need to work with the music side of it and kind of be steered by them creatively. And I think, yeah, that understanding of collaboration has made it easier to win on both sides, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I think so, and I think it's helped that.
And then
that
obviously helps the audience, like, because, you know, no audience historically didn't want to have their music experience interrupted by, like, some big brand logo or ad or something in the middle of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, it occurs to me, you know, some of that is generational, that it helps that, you know, the people now in the brand, you know, at these brands or in the industry are of a generation where these kind of partnerships are acceptable mm-hmm. or expected. Whereas, you know, certainly when I started, the brand people I were talking to had never heard of electronic music or, you know, I started my career when I had to explain that hip hop and rap music were the same thing, because advertisers didn't know that term.
No.
They'd never heard of hip hop.
Mm.
Right. And so
electronic music is a really interesting example of that, I think, because I think there was this real moment when it really became a lot bigger, and brands just knew that that was the where you had that most impassioned audience and like way that you could use it as a tool to communicate, but just didn't know it as well. And I think I sat in a lot of meetings where there was just a real like misalignment between like we need these audiences at Something Like Tomorrow World that are bigger than any other audiences, but no, it was really hard to understand. Like, you couldn't just skin a drum kit or what it, like you used to be able to in the same way. And that, I think, actually the evolution of electronic music actually probably drove brand partnerships forward during that a few years, way more than a lot of the other music spaces, which I think was a lot more that kind of music and brand partnership in other genres was a bit more rudimentary up till then, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is the, you know, certainly the big brand approach is like to give loads of money to the most famous people on earth, right? People that need the money the least.
Yeah.
And you know, electronic music historically hasn't had huge stars, right?
Yeah.
The epicenter is the festivals or the clubs. It's not the DJs. That's changed a little bit, certainly. But even still, Tiësto and Skrillex are not
they're not Lady Gaga and Black Eyed Peas, right? Yeah. That the experience is still kind of at the center of it. And so I think that forces you on the brand side to think differently about how you're going to engage with fans, right?
And to figure out how to infiltrate the experience rather than just brand the artist.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So how does that, I mean, you know, like I was saying earlier, I think Europe's very different in both on the brands and the audience side in terms of how they interact with brands and music. What do you think, what are we learning or need to learn from Europe?
Well, I think the baton's been passed a bit, actually, because I remember when I first moved over here, which was like 2011, being really surprised at how, take this in the way that I intend it, like how unsophisticated the brand approach in culture was.
I think so.
You know, I would switch on the TV and was like, I couldn't believe that a sport was a really big example of that, that would just literally just like a logo on a PowerPoint on a sports show or something. Yep. And I think that in Europe, because we're a lot more, I guess, less bold, I think, in a lot of ways, there was always a more kind of gentle approach with how to kind of integrate brands into things that were done. And but then I think really quickly it shifted. Again, back to maybe electronic music doing it in music specifically, I think there was a real evolution over here in terms of how brands did it, and also how I think maybe because there was more money available from a brand point of view in the US, they figured out really quickly, I think, how to use it really effectively. And I think now there's Europe can kind of take some learnings from that, I think, because we still are a bit reticent in the UK and Europe generally to really embrace that commercialization of things. And I think there's still a hesitancy to understand that it can have a real added value, to the degree that I feel like maybe in this market people have kind of come to understand that a little more and have kind of welcomed the commercial opportunity in to the creative process. I don't know, I feel like it kind of has flip-flopped a little bit. And I think there's still, you know, you look at things like Glastonbury Festival in the UK as an example, and I think they have always been very, very light touch with brands and really pushed back on any brand involvement and everything. And they're slowly learning that it has a real value and that they actually kind of need it a lot more now. But it's still a work in progress, I think.
Yeah.
It was really fun to work internationally, outside of the US and UK when I was at Coke, because the things we were doing there, you could never do in those two markets. Like, Coke had built Coke FM, a digital streaming radio station, and it was the largest streaming radio station in Brazil and Mexico. It was run out of the Coke offices.
Yeah.
And you couldn't do that. You had Spotify and Pandora and everything else. In Southeast Asia, built their own festivals, where Samsung was sponsoring the Coke Festival, right?
Yeah.
And Coke owned it and was monetizing it, and it was not just a marketing tool, but it was a business, and did that in multiple countries. In the Middle East, they started a show in Pakistan called Coke Studio. It was a network TV show where artists would collaborate, and we ended up scaling that to Middle East and Africa, and, like, you know, getting a lot of, you know, value out of it. But you couldn't start a TV show here. It costs like $10 million to do an episode of The Voice. Like, how are you going to compete with that as a brand?
Yeah.
But the things you could do as a brand in different parts of the world, just because it wasn't as crowded, you know, wasn't the competition, were really, really interesting. I think that's, you know, if you're a global brand or you're an international artist, like that's another, you know, it's another opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like such an interesting challenge to think about, you know, a brand like Coke, or the, I don't know if there are any brands like Coke, right, that are literally in every corner of the world.
There's only a handful, really.
Yeah, and that need to, you know, this idea of sort of global strategy, but when every market behaves differently and has different stars and different trends and different regulatory environments and all of that stuff.
But music, I think, is one of the only, like, cultural verticals. We were talking about this recently, that if you are a brand with a global strategy, that it makes sense to execute within, because sport, like, brands spend so much more money in sport, but that's not, it just doesn't translate. It doesn't, like, music can connect to every person and has the opportunity to connect to every person in every different market, and it transcends borders. Whereas I feel like in sport, you sponsor a team, and if you don't like that team, then it doesn't reach you. Or if you don't like sport, especially sure. someone who's not into sport, like if there would be no brand resonance with me if they sponsor a sports team or game or something. So yeah, I feel like a global strategy for a brand, it has to be rooted in music in some way, because then yeah, you activate it locally, but that as a kind of cultural marketing strategy, it feels like it's the only one that really makes sense.
Yeah,
it's hyper local. That's the great thing. I mean, with sports, there's so, it can be really easy, like you said, like sport, you could do your local team, you could do your national league, or you could do FIFA World Cup, right? And there's like sort of these tiers, and you can get scale out of it. With music, you can do the hyper-local really well, right? There's a few global properties, but not many. So I think when you're looking to get scale or consistency, that's where the complexities come in. You kind of have to stitch together this, and that's where, to your point, strategy is important.
Sure.
Like, what is the strategy around, you know, music? And yeah. that's where, you know, I think brands are getting much more sophisticated. And yeah, maybe it is a generational thing, like you were saying. But I'm actually really happy the book came out now, as opposed to like a few years ago when we started writing it, because there's this tipping point happening. And I'll give credit to TikTok, I guess, where, you know, now all of a sudden music is top of mind on every
oh, yeah.
brand marketers, because you've got this platform that 96% of the people are listening while they're watching content. Didn't
sure.
exist on Facebook and Instagram and everything else. So now you've got this great, you know, sound on platform in TikTok, and now music's like top of mind for everyone. And brands are realizing like, oh yeah, we need to be involved in the space. And it goes back to like, well, what's our strategy? Well, we don't really have one yet. So
right.
I think that it's starting to bubble up. I think it's part of a tipping point, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let me holler at you one more time about DraftKings. Football is back in full swing with another week of epic games. And who's got you covered on the action? DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. New customers can bet $5 on football and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Nobody's missing out on the action this season. All DraftKings customers can take advantage of two new offers every game day this September. Get in on the NFL Week 2 action with DraftKings Sportsbook. Download the app now and use my code REBELRADIO to sign up. New customers can bet $5 and take home $200 instantly in bonus bets only on DraftKings Sportsbook with code REBELRADIO. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. See sportsbook.draftkings.com/football terms for eligibility, terms, and responsible gaming resources. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. Eligibility and deposit restrictions apply.
One of the other things you talk about in the book that I think is really challenging for marketers, maybe for all of us, is sort of the death of genre. Right, and I mean, I think it's a long, slow death. I don't know that genre will ever disappear completely, but you know, the way I look at it is, you know, genre was incredibly important when we had record stores, because you need to know, you don't have time to search through,
yeah.
you know, all the racks, so you need to know where to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a CD was only in one place at a time, unless it was on the end cap as well, right? But obviously, none of that matters in the digital environment. But you know, at the same time, and I think you pointed out in the book that music is also tied to our identities, and especially when we're teenagers, mm-hmm. frankly, right? When identity is forming, you know, music tells us who to hang out with, who not to hang out with, how to dress, how to talk, mm-hmm. you know, and in some cases, how to think about life. You know, punk rock lifestyle and attitude comes with there's a set of morality, right?
Right.
And hip hop has a different one, and, you know, et cetera. So, what do you think, first of all, an unfair question, what do you think it means for that process of forming identity if we're not using genre as a as a stand-in. Yeah, let's start there.
That's such an interesting question because, I mean, yeah, you're so right. Like when we were all growing up, it was, that was the kind of the one defining thing. It was the first question that people would ask each other.
It was like a starter kit, right?
Totally. And it was, you really, I mean, I, as a teenager in the 90s, there was, I don't know if you knew about it much over here, but there was that whole Oasis versus Blur battle and you literally had to, you picked a side.
Yeah.
And that defined who you were for, right, for years to come after
sure.
that. And I don't know that
we had our versions of that here.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, I mean, it really was like everyone was kind of either grungy or emo, no one was into pop or whatever.
Right.
And it's now you can, yeah, it's really different now. I think, I don't know, I've kind of forgotten what your question was actually, but it's such an interesting topic that I think about a lot just because it was such a pertinent part of like growing up for us and your identity. And now like, what does...
Yeah, the unfair question is, what do you do if you're a teenager, right? How are you supposed to gel that
like,
identity? And I guess the more relevant question is what should marketers do, mm-hmm. right? If you, because, you know, we all remember, we're like, oh, you know, I took science. Science was like, we want to be hip hop. Or, you know, 7-Up's like, we want to be EDM.
Yeah.
It was easy back then, right? And I think, you know, because this has come up before and, like, haven't sort of, you know, nailed it. We probably should do some research on this. But what I've seen is that back in when we were doing that with the hip-hop and the thing, and we were kind of closing ourselves off,
sure.
right? It was like, these are your friends, this is what you dress, this is what you do, and you hadn't kind of had these distinctions. Whereas today, I think you're seeing people borrow a lot from a little thing. Like I could borrow a little bit from Drake, a little bit from this, a little bit of that. And it's sort of, it's an amalgamation. Music is sort of like, you're an amalgamation of all the music that you listen to, all the different styles of music you listen to.
Yeah.
And that actually opens up more connection opportunity, right? Because you're not sort of, you know, alienating people or putting people in boxes because of music genres.
Sure.
So I think it's actually a more homogenous, you know? Like
becomes,
culture than it was before.
It becomes like audience first, doesn't it? It's like a brand will know the audience that they want to connect with, but that manifests in so many different ways. And that, you know, is part of the reason, again, that we wrote the book, because everything is so much more fragmented these days. So if that's your audience segmentation, they align with so many different things. So let's spread and work with 10 different artists that represent all those things that are emerging and support the growth of them versus that hanging your hat and all your budget on one and hoping for the best, which makes it so much more interesting, gives the brand a lot more opportunity to support and really invest in the music scene as a whole. But it's obviously a lot more complicated to try and kind of figure out. And I think also then you get, I think it's audience first, but also channel first.
Right.
I think there's a lot of those decisions these days.
I always challenge brands to not look at genres so much. And I think we talk about this in the book. But we talk about...
need to reread it.
Yeah. We talk a lot about how music as a mood enhancer or to, you know, set, you know, amplify a moment or an occasion. And I think that gets really interesting because every brand plays a role in people's lives, right? It does something, right? It's either a mood, a moment, occasion, something. It makes me feel something. And music makes me feel something. So how do you parallel the two? Becomes much easier in a sense than genre, right? And trying to figure out like what's my brand personality, what genre. So I think if you can align those moods and moments, and it could be as, you know, I love this example and it's really a little bit hokey, but you know, Barilla Pasta created Alexa playlists.
Is that right?
And what they did is they did it based on the amount of time it takes to cook your different types of pasta. So you had a Fusilli playlist and linguine, and you say, Alexa, play the Fusilli playlist, and by the time the playlist was done, your pasta was done, but we all know it always takes a minute or two extra. But but I thought that was interesting as an example, because here's a pasta company that actually found an interesting role in the music experience. You know, music is part of their brand experience.
Yeah.
So it's almost like if they can do it, pretty much every other brand, you know, has a meaningful role to play.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think part of it I don't know why your story reminded me. I was talking to the GM of Adidas at the end of Yeezy season one, and so you know there was all this press about how, you know, Kanye had turned around Adidas or whatever, and we were talking about it, and it was like, you know,
that collection was extremely limited, right? And he was like the, you know, it was like they made $5 million gross or something off of that season, right? And probably had to pay it all to Kanye. And so he was like, you know, the value that that brought was it gave our 5,000 employees something to get excited about coming to work on every day, not the financial returns on that particular collection, right? And I think, you know, for these big companies, that's a big part of it, right? And it's back to kind of the human element, right? You have all these human beings, these huge sales forces or whatever, inside of a company that needs something to rally around.
Yeah, but that's an interesting example of when you hang your hat on one thing,
sure.
The risk that goes with it as
well.
Well,
yeah,
we see.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you
right, and I think you make a good point about spreading that risk a bit.
Yeah.
Sure. But I think it's, you know, that's the thing of Barilla, like, did people listening to that playlist actually sell more pasta? Who knows?
No, but it was a story you could tell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, and it was in a story they could tell internally to get people, you know, excited that this sleepy brand category is now involved in music in an interesting way, and sometimes that's enough.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I was impressed. I mean, keep going back to the Mercedes thing, but when I went to the little race in Atlanta, and it wasn't little, it was a pretty big race, but there were guys from the band there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and like you said, they showed up. Yeah. And I think, you know, whether it's, you know, a brand, I mean, a brand is just a collection of individuals, just like a record label is, just like an artist is, right? And I think, you know, like you said, like going back to that personal connection, it also creates a sense of accountability, right? Like if you don't hold up your end of the deal, you're not impacting Coca-Cola, the company. You're impacting
the
brand manager who comes to work every day and doesn't need that headache and is trying to do her job and, you know, excel in her career. So it's, there is a relationship. And it's good though. I think that we're seeing like the two sort of cultures hang out more together. Mm-hmm. Like I noticed, you know, and we talked a little bit before this about South by Southwest, and you know, part of the downside about the expansion of South by Southwest is it's impossible to navigate. But you're actually getting, you know, music and brand people, you know, together, which is nice. You're seeing it more at, you know, conferences like The Gathering or even Advertising Week, where you're, you know, seeing more music people show up. That's going to help.
Yeah,
it does help.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tempting to forget people, you know, everyone's a fan of something, right? And as you said, like music is this sort of great connector to people all over the world. And, you know, brand people are fans just as much as everyone else. What you tell a lot of great stories in the book. Can you think of something that you've never seen done before that you'd like to see happen in music?
In music,
oh, that's such a big
and
question.
Brands?
Yeah.
I think a lot about like a brand having. I mean, obviously, there's brands like Coca-Cola, but a brand having real longevity, like having a long-term plan that goes beyond their three-year pivot and investing in music. And, you know, there's a whole groundswell of brands who are understanding the benefit of being there at grassroots, and they get involved at a grassroots level with emerging artists, but then pivot their strategy after a few years. And there's very few brands that have gone into it long, long, long term. And I think we always talk about things like Red Bull Music Academy, who did.
Yeah.
But then the next layer from that is like going this kind of emerging grassroots. Like, I'd love to see a brand like really put their resources behind actually developing artists in a lot more of a, like, but seeing them through their entire journey. And I know we were talking yesterday about that other example of like Lego creating the llama, like actually creating an artist. But that's kind of an example that's a bit further than that, but actually really becoming responsible for like an artist's success on a much deeper level than just kind of, I guess, riding on the tailcoats when they are successful or kind of creating a grassroots program and then backing out again. I'd love to see a brand like to kind of raise to the ground their strategy and just actually decide to invest in like X amount of different artists across every different genre, and actually like get them there, because it's so much harder for artists to do that these days. And I think I also speak a lot about the fact that I think, especially kind of on the back of COVID, brands have got a real duty of care to like invest back into the music industry that they've capitalized on for so long. And now that it's, there's various different challenges more than there ever has been, I think, in terms of that are prohibitive to the success of music, like actually like really pivot really intelligently and invest long term in whether, yeah, whether it's a certain scene or collection of artists.
I think that's interesting. There's a because that happened on the brand side when you invest in emerging artists. I did this in 2010. I had an artist in a TV commercial.
Right.
2 years later, she's with the competitor.
She's no longer. Well, you know what I'm saying? Sure. Right.
Right.
Well, they, like, that's a great point. There's a challenge on the talent side, right?
Because it wasn't the mechanic wasn't there to take advantage and build the relationship like you're talking about. And I guess sports probably has a lot we can learn because you see, like, they'll invest in an athlete early and then incentivize them along the way. Hey, you win the Grand Slam, we're going to give you an extra this, you know, and it's worth money well spent because now you have a Grand Slam winning, you know, tennis player. But like, you could do the same thing with an artist and say, all right, if you go platinum, if you win a Grammy, you know, and kind of incentivize them along the way.
Yeah.
So you're both winning in the upside, like you're talking about. I think that's really interesting.
But it's still a much more of a dirty word in music than it is in sport. It's okay for a brand to own an athlete.
Sure.
And to, but it's you know, I think it would really, there's still a lot of work to be done. And that has to come from the brand side in terms of how they approach things. But that it feels like it's a kind of authentic an acceptable element to like an artist's success is to have a brand like through there as the journey, like pushing that.
Yeah, I love that answer. I mean, I've pitched multiple brands on building a real record label. I built one for Scion that they did cool things with, but didn't purposely didn't take it that seriously. And then I went out and pitched a bunch of others who just they couldn't see.
Yeah. The label model is a really good way to do it. And it's been, like Scion and a few of the, a good handful of brands have done it. But again, it's been a real short term.
Yeah.
Like, I just expecting to see some kind of shift or success overnight. And
I think it goes back to what you're saying about strategy, right? And a lot of times, if something gets sold in as an emerging artist program, then we're going to put, you know, a small check and 10 of these artists and lift their career, and then you're sort of done. You've moved on to the next thing, right? Or, I mean, I had Kevin Lyman, who's the founder of the Warped Tour, on the show. We, you know, we talked about his partnership with Vans, which I think is one of the rare exceptions to that, right? And you know, the Warped Tour wouldn't exist without Vans.
Yeah.
Vans arguably wouldn't be who they are today without that affiliation that's now, you know, that's 20 years in.
There's such a propensity, I think, to jump on the new shiny thing or the next shiny thing, and also just that, like, the marketing strategies that pivot or new teams that change around.
That's a huge challenge.
It's a huge challenge, but then you just look, like, everyone, I'm sure, like, 95% of the people that you ask, like, what are the most successful brand music programs, they will all cite the same, like Warped Tour, Rebel Music Academy, and it's just, and they're the ones who were like in it for the long haul and involved with the artists and involved with the scene and the industry, rather than kind of, you know, you can support an emerging artist. They don't have, and if they don't emerge fast enough, like you don't have to pivot away from them. Like persevere and then you,
Well, it's funny. I was at my physical therapist yesterday, and she was talking about this Rick Rubin show or something she'd seen Rick Rubin on, whatever, and she's like, oh, he's, you know, the guy's amazing, he's had all these hits, and I said, I said, yes, Rick's incredible, and, you know, he's an icon, and I said, but, you know, in the documentary, whatever it was, he gets to talk about the hits and overlook all the misses, right, and that's not a criticism of Rick, but that's true for all of us, right, in that, brands, you know, we don't, people are not judged on their batting average, they're judged on their home runs. Mm. And brands sometimes forget that, right? In this sort of risk-averse culture, they'd rather have a small win that's maybe not even a really a win than take the risk at a loss.
Yeah.
So there's another thing that I don't know if brands are doing, but I think there's something in this sort of idea. we all know that like music artists create culture. Like if you're an artist, you have to start with fan one, then fan 10, then fan 100, then fan 1,000 and a million, right? You're building a brand, right? Yeah. You're starting, you know, with nothing and building, you know, equity. There's something to be said for that. And, you know, brands, we have the benefit of kind of stepping back and kind of leveraging the cultural bits that kind of bubble up and are interesting, right? Yeah. But if you get to it, like, what value can an artist and that perception, that perspective, bring to a brand's marketing plan, right? If you actually brought them in, you know, at the strategic, at the creative level, right?
Absolutely.
And help them sort of shape what, you know, we see it with artists that do their own brands. Uh-huh. You know, they become really, really successful based on their vision.
Yeah.
Like, I would love to see what an artist, we actually did a little bit of that at Coke, because when we did the thing with Mark Ronson in the Olympics, like, he was a partner of ours for a year, and he was sitting at the table with the creative director of our agency talking about the TV commercial.
Yeah.
And, like, the work got better for it, you know?
Yeah, a few brands have done it, haven't they, as well? Like, we were talking the other day about, like, Diddy and Ciroc and a few of those others. But, like, that is, you know, those are kind of extreme examples, and also they're where they've brought in a huge artist from the beginning. But, you know, bringing those cultural creators, the musicians, as creative directors, or as like the who helped define the kind of creative strategy, I think it would be good to see that. I also want to see brands investing more in like the bit, the all the parts we're losing from the music industry, like the bricks and mortars, like build studios, build stores. Like, I think the, you know, there's a real, as the kind of, I guess, needs to be, but everyone's moving towards the more, the metaverse and those kind of how they activate in those. But like, let's bring it back a little bit and kind of create, like, build the, invest in the real world things that we need to create, actually.
Oh, I love that. Because like, when I grew up in Providence, like, the only music experience I had was the record store.
Sure.
Like, so, you know, like, people knew music, you're talking about music, you know, like, it was, even if you didn't go buy anything, you just wanted to hang around there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and we're starting
like
to lose
that music experience, create the homes again where people can make stuff, can buy stuff. Like, that's that would be a great brand opportunity, I think. Like, and I know there's like Microsoft, I think we're starting to do some interesting things in that space, like actually kind of create those creator spaces and studios, but like evolve it more into community hubs, like bringing people together. Yeah, I would love. With brand budgets, that's what I mean.
Yeah, we got really close years ago on a Lucky Brand Studios. They, in the middle of it, the CMO got a new job and moved to New York, and the new team forgot all about it.
It's happened. Do you know there was a?
I mean, that's what happens.
There was a really good example of this actually, which was a guy, Matt Bruin, who was the CMO at Smirnoff for a while. Went to Pabst Brewing Co. And he, I don't actually really know what happened. I think COVID actually, but they were developing plans to build in, God, I can't remember where their headquarters is, somewhere in Texas, but like not one of the key kind of hubs. They were going to build this whole space, which was like, which was music studios, which was like a big bar, co-working space, like every part of a creative hub. And then they would also create all the content from their own, like, own and work with artists that came through it.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I think COVID happened actually, but that was a really great example, I think, of like, let's bring back all the different, that end-to-end music experience and like facilitate it. Like, we'll build it and they will come kind of thing. Like, let's have a event space on the roof and skate parks and actually just like create the thing that for everyone else to then be able to use and make from, which I loved that one, and sad that it didn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe you'll get someone else to build it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Well, we're going to lose the studio soon, so I better wrap us up. But, well, just a question on strategy. Are there specific goals for the book, for what you guys want to achieve? Is there another book? Are there other books in the pipeline?
There's the thing that's really come out of the back of the book is what we kind of intended it for, which is why we actually called it the Field Guide, which is that people are just like really focusing on the kind of the tools part of it, that kind of almost like because we purposefully created it, so it was like a guide for people to be able to use There's a couple of thoughts around. We've been approached by a few kind of colleges about like starting earlier in the funnel and kind of creating syllabuses or programs people can kind of learn from it. But also, We were talking, been talking a lot about how we evolve it into more of a functional, like workbook or toolkit or something that can actually be really applicable in kind of daily work.
That's great.
Something that we're kind of interested in exploring.
Yeah. It's funny, like when it came out, like we're not authors by trade and it's kind of a niche subject.
Now you are.
Now we are. And it's a niche subject.
That's how you become an author, right?
We put it out and it's like number one on the music business on Amazon and number one new release on marketing. We're like, holy crap, people are actually going to read this thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a really interesting experience because, you know, in our worlds, like we're always creating for others, like for brands.
Sure.
This is, for me, this is the first time I actually was involved in creating something that wasn't dictated by a strategy or a brief.
Right.
You know?
That's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that I think we'd love to kind of evolve it into just seeing how we can then translate that into actual, like, real tangible, like, practices and hopefully kind of encourage. We're both super motivated by trying to figure out how we can channel more investment into music. I mean, that's music is the area that we both went into this whole career in the first place. So,
sure.
Like, how we can, what are the ways that we can kind of use this to be able to empower other people to be able to invest more and more effectively into music where it's needed? So, yeah, we're playing around with that.
Yeah, that's great. And I think, you know, for as someone who's, you know, spent my career sort of along the same path, we would all do better sharing more information, you know, sharing more freely with each other, right? I think there's a bigger upside when, as you said, when the brands and the industry are more sort of open and have more tools to work with.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's one of the failures of marketing overall is, you know, you get these case studies that are presented at conferences or on blogs that just completely gloss over all of the challenges and failures along the way.
Yeah.
And they tell these incomplete stories just to, you know, aimed at making the presenter look good.
Yeah.
And what we really all need is to learn.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate you guys doing this. I've been doing this 30 years and I learned things reading the book. And
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks for reading it.
Yeah, no, it was awesome. Let me do a quick lightning round before I let you get out of here. And you can both answer or you can take turns or whatever you want to do. What's your favorite city to travel to?
Amsterdam is mine.
Oh, Bangkok.
Love it there.
Bangkok.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I've never been.
No, yeah. I've never been either.
Oh, the people are amazing.
Nice. Yeah. This one I'm going to require you both to answer. Who's your favorite DJ?
Annie Mack, which is a really middle-aged woman.
I love Annie Mack.
Answer, but I love her. She's just launched these new events in the UK, which are called Before Midnight, and it's specifically for like mums and parents, basically. Yep. So she does like a full club night, but it wraps at 11:59 p.m. so everyone can get home and get to bed.
I love that.
She's like, why do you have to stay up to 6 a.m. to listen to good music? So I'm obsessed with her. And I always dance my ass off at her show.
I love that. And the older I get, the more I appreciate day drinking. And like, you know, I have friends who come to LA to DJ and I'm like, you know, call me when you're doing a pool party because I'm not coming out. If you're starting at midnight, luckily, you know, we still close early here, but
yeah.
I'm not coming at midnight.
No, well, exactly. And that is a very middle-aged answer, but yeah.
No, it's great. She's awesome.
And she's also an author and everything else. She's like a bit of a hero of mine. Not the coolest answer, but.
Joe, who's your favorite DJ?
Me?
Yeah.
Grandmaster Flash.
Hell yeah.
I'm back on the 80s hip-hop thing.
And he's a legit great DJ. I've booked him and watched him.
Oh, that's a good answer. Yeah.
What's the last great book you read other than your own?
Oh, I'm trying to think. I read so much. This is like my other like side, but I do book reviews on Instagram book reviews.
Oh, cool.
So I read at least a book a week.
Nice.
Like about 50 or 60 a year. So what's my favorite good book I read? Oh my God, I can't think. Can I come back to that one?
That's easy. Sure. I read a book a year. So
there you go.
Me.
Easier to pick from.
The Chris Blackwell book was great.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
Nice.
What a story.
Oh, do you know, mine was Shuggy Bane, maybe. Mm. It was like a really good, did you read it?
Uh-uh.
Douglas Stewart book. Oh my God, that's so good. I recommend adding that to your list. It's the most like visceral, brutal, emotive, amazing book by a Scottish author.
Really?
So that's a good one.
Awesome, yeah. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
How do you...
You have so many options to choose.
You read
well,
a book
the thing,
a week? How's
like
the...
Is
it a particular genre or are you just any book?
But any kind of any book. Yeah. I have like all kind of novels. I like a lot of like human story novels. But yeah, I mean, yes, I don't. I've always been a prolific reader, but in lockdown, I started to like record them all. And now I've kind of started accidentally like an online social book club where I just post a book and just there's loads of conversations on the back of it. But
that's
there's
awesome.
Too many to choose from. That's
the
thing.
For sure.
I feel like 2022 wasn't a great book year either. So I'm this
oh, really?
One. This one started out of the gates much stronger with some good recommendations.
So, nice.
Yeah.
I started reading novels again after. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah. Mm.
From probably high school to then, I didn't read a single single fiction.
Really?
And
gosh.
I read nonfiction and, you know, whatever.
Oh, my God, I love it. I just, there's nothing. Also, it's my biggest talk because if I watch TV, I'm always on my phone as well.
Uh-huh.
And so that
sure.
is another reason why I read so many books, because it makes me put my phone down and probably detach.
Nice. I got to read the Chris Blackwell book, too. That's great. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
Not a very cool answer again. You're exposing me. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. 100%.
Okay.
Oh, wow. That's like my favorite movie since I was a kid, and I've seen it.
Nothing wrong with that one.
Not a very cool answer, but that would be it.
I would say for me, it was probably Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, although my answer's changed.
The
original one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's changed to Free Guy. Like,
my kid
watches that movie, like, every other day. Like, I've seen that thing 1,000 times. It's actually
Fair
a really
enough.
Good movie.
Yeah, it's decent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's someone you haven't met who you've learned a lot from?
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably say David Geffen.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, like you, I read a lot of, for me, it's nonfiction biographies, and I got
Yeah, his book's amazing.
Understanding his mindset and his journey and just, it was interesting.
Nice.
I haven't achieved that level of success yet, but I read the book. That's something.
I'm sure it's inspired something that you've done.
there's too many people to choose from, really, because there's so many different areas, as well as,
you read too much.
Yeah, and as well as like music and books, I'm also super interested in like health and nutrition and like holistic alternative medicines. And there's probably a couple of podcasters, like, well, not really podcasters by trade, but Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, I feel like I learn a lot from just because I'm so fascinated in this subject matter. And he just interviews amazing guests about that whole kind of spectrum of like health and living well.
Oh, cool.
I would say maybe him just because that's something, he talks a lot about things that I'm interested in and don't know much about.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, last question. If we work together, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
If we work together, probably sure, go for it. Like I say that all the time. If anyone has an idea, I'm like, sure, let's go for it.
Nice.
What's the worst that can happen?
Mm.
That's probably
like
what you'd
that.
Hear me say.
Yeah. For me, what do you think? Like, yeah. I know what I think. I'm just curious what, you know.
Great.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I think we both love learning from
qualities.
Other people, but I just love working. I like having teams of people who just, I love getting their ideas and just seeing if we can do something from it, which is,
why I
was like, let's do it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. It was great having you both.
Cool. Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks for spending time with us. Everyone check out How Music Grows Brands, and can't wait to see the next evolution.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good stuff.
Yo, that was Rebecca Jolly and Joe Belliotti on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Go ahead and get you a copy of How Music Grows Brands, and most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.